Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, Abigail Walls, Simon Schuster, and the boss, John Rurink. Matt Resch from Resch Strategies is going to be joining us in a little bit. But first, Jacob, we are going to conceivably have some news this week on what's going to happen in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Why should we care about what's going on there?
This city in Wisconsin has asked to divert some water from the Great Lakes for use in its town. The problem is they're in a county that straddles the line that separates them from the Great Lakes Basin and the Mississippi Basin. So the county is technically in the basin, but the city is not. So the governors have to get together and decide whether to approve whether the city can use water from the Great Lakes. My understanding that there has to be unanimous approval from all the governors, leaders of these states and provinces that touch the Great Lakes. One veto can turn it down. So the question remains is who is going to vote for this agreement if that's what they try to do, and I believe there's a decision coming Tuesday. What's interesting is that Governor Snyder, like most of the other governors, has not tipped his hand whether it said yes or no. It could be interesting that he has not come out definitively and said that he would say no, which might raise some questions from environmentalists and people here in the state.
In fact, it seems like any type of public hint you can get on this would have him saying that he would go yes on this, just based on kind of the train of thought that his Office of Great Lakes is going on, which has been centered on the data. And does the request from Waukesha fit all of these different buckets? And as far as we can tell right now, Simon Schuster, is that Waukesha is fitting all the buckets. They're already taking water from the Great Lake Basin. This would just regulate it.
Yeah, certainly. But I think for the environmentally inclined, this all rests on a slippery slope argument. Because today, it may be a small town in Wisconsin that's just outside the basin. But if you're the sort of person who stays up at night worrying about these sorts of issues, then tomorrow it might be the city of Phoenix. And it was 118 degrees there yesterday.
So we're getting back to the whole water diversion issue here, Jacob. Are we going to have a building of a pipeline from the Lake Michigan to the sandy shores of Arizona? We're going to have the big straw-sucking sound again. I think we remember that, don't we, Jack?
Well, yeah, but that's totally unrealistic. It costs so much to do that. The real threat has always been in the states like Wisconsin that have a certain amount of their basin in the Great Lakes Basin and then another part of their state outside of the Great Lakes Basin. And that includes places, you know, like the other states in the region, Ohio, other places like that. When you look at it, that's why Michigan is kind of such an important player in this, because Michigan's the one that's entirely in the Great Lakes Basin.
So we would never be put in the situation that a town in Wisconsin would be, or a town in Ohio or New York.
Yeah. These other states and that touch on the basin that are part of the charter group, they could have some real incentive, to vote yes. Whereas in Michigan, you've got, again, right in the center, obviously. So it makes it interesting aspects. The other thing is, technically, this is not, if you're attorneys and you fight this through the courts, technically, this group is voluntary, the charter group. So they really don't have any authority over this. It's just that they have basically been able to veto things like this in the past. So you've got a lot of elements coming together here. It'd be interesting to predict what Governor Snyder does ultimately.
Me personally, I've not seen, I haven't really dove deep into the quality of the application, but I've just been interested in the politics of this decision. How it's going to be really easy for opponents, especially environmentalists, people that are protecting the Great Lakes. I know Schuette has come out against it to try to put Snyder on the spot to say, how could you say yes to this vote to divert water to the Great Lakes? I can see that being a big political issue for Snyder going forward with all the opponents that have lined up against it.
Like he needs more of that.
Yeah, certainly. And like other environmental issues, what's interesting, unlike other environmental issues, what's interesting about this one is that it seems to cross ideological lines, because it has less to do with the environmental integrity of the Great Lakes and more to do with the idea that the Great Lakes are a regional asset that the regional partners that are a part of the basin have to protect, and that by allowing Waukesha to divert water, that they may be rendering that in jeopardy.
All right. Well, we're going to keep our eyes on that and obviously keep our readers informed as far as what we hear with that Waukesha water diversion, where Snyder is going on that. Well, last week we hired Practical Political Consultants to do some polling in the 10th Congressional District. And Abby, before we go through the results, I think that this is probably maybe the headline coming out of this, is that Practical Political Consultants did 5,000 robocalls on last Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and we got 225 completes out of 5,000 robopulls. What do you read out of that?
I think anyone that's listening to those numbers knows that most people don't pick up their landlines anymore, and that's what that's reflective of, in addition to a level of apathy when it comes to 2016. We've been hearing about 2016 for, November 5, 2014. We got this ball rolling right after Election Day 2 years ago. I think people are a little bit burned out when it comes to politics.
You know, what's really interesting, John, is we've been doing some polling for a while with Practical Political Consultants, and these robopolls are not anything new. But, you know, in the past, it seems like we get, you know, on the low end, 7%. 10% is usually common. 13 to 15 if things are really exciting. I think we got 20% one time when we were on a real hot issue. Getting 4.5% is a new low bar.
I think it's just reflective of changing technology and what's going on with the phones. And it's going to be really interesting to see in the coming years how good polling is. We've had a lot of issues this election cycle with polling, really miscalling races. And it's because, you get a phone call and you just on your cell phone and you don't recognize the number. Who takes it? Nobody. And who answers their home phone? I mean, I have one because I'm under contract in a bundle, but I don't even have it plugged in, so.
And the problem here is not that cell phones, you know, it's not possible to do polling with cell phones. The cell phone numbers are available to pollsters. It's just a lot more costly
to get that. It differently than they do their home phone. The way we viewed a home phone and when I was growing up, you had to answer it. It was like a responsibility to answer it. Now it's much more, am I going to be bothered or am I just going to click hang up because I don't recognize the number?
Or, for example, as anyone who's received a call from the House reporter, me, knows, I have a 202 number, but I live in Lansing, I'm a Lansing voter, so how would a pollster know to give me a ring?
Well, that's a very good point, too, because the numbers on cell phones are all over the map. You may be talking to somebody on the West Coast and not realize it. Yeah, I do think it's reaching critical mass now. For a while, you could still get away with the landlines because even though the percentage of people answering landlines are older, because they voted in such larger numbers, you still came out of it with a reasonable, you know, with some reasonable numbers. Now, as you see, it's all becoming far more difficult. It's, and by the way, older, more likely to bother to answer a pollster too, or the automated system. But I think now it's really kind of making it a real random, injecting a random concept into this whole process of polling. And you also have to wonder if reporters and news outlets have trouble with this, what is it doing to campaigns? Because they use polling all the time.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, we just came off a primary where Bernie Sanders won Michigan, and nobody had that on their radar. So now you've got, you know, and maybe this kind of speaks to that, in that the younger voters who are all supporting Bernie Sanders don't have home phones. It's hard to get them on their cell phones. It's hard to get them to respond when they do. And so you're missing such a key element of the population, so much that multiple pollsters, in fact, everyone who polled Michigan, got that particular race wrong. And I think this may just be a reflection of that. When you've got a bunch of robopolls going out, who is picking up the phone anymore? I've got one. My phone rings, and you know, maybe I'll have the kids pick up to entertain them. But other than that, I only pick it up when I know it's a radio station.
Yeah. So these lead to the question. So we talked about the dynamic of people not picking up their landlines, the use of cell phones. Jack mentioned the cost, and you know, still not a lot of use of cell phone in polls. This all, and then just the apathy of the election. This all just leads to the big question of how do we get reliable information about the status of a race. I mean, if people aren't picking up their phones to participate in a poll, I mean, it's a very interesting dynamic in our political.
Yeah, do you go online now? Do you do email polls? I mean, is that where we got to go?
Or even I'm wondering if focus grouping is where you go. It is traditionally more expensive, but in a sort of post-party, post-ideological election cycle, is it more important to have your finger to the pulse of what key voting groups are thinking and what they want to hear out of a candidate than it is to know rote numbers of how many people are going to vote for which candidate?
I think what's going to happen with polling is it's going to become increasingly complex, and you're going to have pollsters are starting to look at what they call geographic gating. where it's all internet-based, where I can send you a poll question or send you an ad because you happen to fall in the geographic area of the district. And that's going to be changing a lot over the next decade as these technologies become more and more pervasive. And it's just going to be a matter of how do we balance it and do it the right way so it becomes predictive again.
I think, though, rather than going full-fledged digital right away, I think we're definitely going to see a transition of mediums. Because, I mean, when you think about the demographics you're capturing with a landline poll, I think it's fair to say that you're probably not getting a whole lot of voters under the age of 35, certainly not. And but if you're switching to, you know, a fully online or app-based or internet-based polling system, you're still also not going to be capturing people that are, you know, octogenarians. And so you really want to, I think that there's going to be a transition where we're going to see cross-medium polling where a lot of these different factors intersect.
Well, it'll be interesting because we know for years there were a lot of voters who complained that polls drove the entire process and that these nasty politicians were always reacting to polls. Well, this should make them happy now. Now there's not the polling there and they're going to have to, you know, the politicians, you got to guess, are going to be actually saying more of what they really think because they don't have these polls they can rely on to drive what their positions are.
So they're going to have to find something else to complain about.
They will.
Well, joining us now on the podcast, and we'll get his take on this, is Matt Resch from Resch Strategies. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks, Kyle.
Well, we just got some results from some robo-polling we did in the 10th Congressional District, and that's a district that you've done some work in with Senator Phil Pavlov. And before we actually get to the results, what we thought was very interesting was the very low number of responses we actually received. We worked with Practical Political Consultants and asked 5,000 people and did robo-polling in 5,000 households. We got 225 completes back, which is about 4.5%. Now, we've been doing these robo-polls for a few years now, and typically we expect to get about 10%. And if the issue is hot, then we'll get a bit more. We'll get into the 13%. We're only 45 days away from an election, and we got 4.5% response rate. What do you make of that?
Well, I think a couple things play into that. I think, for one, I think it's a challenge that pollsters are facing all over the place in having more and more people move away from a traditional landline telephone to a cell phone. And I think people just don't want to answer their phones anymore. I think that they know that if someone who they want to talk to is going to call them, they're going to call the cell phone number, and the home number is not anything that they're going to use. So I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is that this primary in the 10th is unique, is that, you know, there is an election coming up in 5 or 6 weeks, but there's not much else going on coming up in Michigan heading into August 2nd. You know, the presidential primary was this spring, so there's not any real political, you know, conversation driving interest in an election this summer. And I think, too, that, you know, the primary season, no matter who you voted for or who you wanted to win, both parties are so splintered, and I think a lot of people are disaffected, disinterested, disgusted by the whole process. And politics in the middle of a beautiful Michigan summer is the last thing that they're going to be thinking about.
So do you think that this whole Clinton-Trump thing has kind of spoiled the well for people like your candidate?
Daily run into people who just say, I'm not following this election. Again, I'm not going to read any news. You know, I'm not going to watch it on TV. I'm done. I'm not going to pay attention to this election. I've got two people who I don't like, don't know what I'm going to do when I go into the voting booth in November. But yeah, there is a lot of apathy, and I think that that will trickle down into the election. I think one thing you've also seen in the 10th is that no one knew that Candace Miller was going to retire. I think some people speculated that she might be coming at some point, but I don't think anyone expected it to come as soon in the cycle as it did. So this election, this campaign has been going on for a long time. I mean, it started last March. And so folks like Phil and for Paul Mitchell and Sanborn, who have been in it for a while, it's a long slog. It's different than some other congressional races and primaries where it's a much tighter calendar. We've been at this for a long time, and so I think it's slowly building up. You know, the mail is starting to fly. Internet ads, TV ads are starting to appear. So I think interest will obviously uptick when those things start to settle in.
Yeah, and that's got to be hard for a campaign to try and cut through just this type of voter apathy that you're seeing here. And just taking a look at the results of the polls, I mean, it looks like Mitchell, Pavlov are doing pretty good. You know, Sanborn's, you know, kind of in a second tier with Forlini. How do you cut through that? How do you get people excited about a race that they're not necessarily excited about?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to come down to the ground game and building that grassroots support that campaigns need. I think that's one thing I know that Phil Pavlo has been focused on a great deal. And, you know, I worked with Phil when he ran for his Senate seat this last time when he was running against Terry Brown. And one thing I learned in that part of the state, because he inherited two new counties that he hadn't represented in the previous term, there are some pretty solid relationships, and familiarity is important. Even going into Republican counties, people knew Terry Brown, and they liked Terry Brown. And they would say, you know what, I know you're a Republican, and I'm a Republican, but I've known Terry for 20 years. So I think when it comes down to it, those kinds of relationships in these communities, especially Macomb and the Thumb, it's going to be very important, because I think, you know, regardless of the poll numbers that Mark's polls showed, probably the two most important numbers are going to be the numbers 53, that's how many years Phil Pavlo has lived and worked and served in that district, and 28, that's how many days Paul Mitchell lived in the district before he filed to run in the district. You know, money can say some things, but that's 53 years of personal relationships with people throughout that district versus 28 days that Paul Mitchell moved in and decided he wanted to run for his latest office.
But Paul Mitchell did have a business, though, that was centered. His base was in St. Clair. He ran for city council there, served on the
briefly.
City council.
Yeah, he served very briefly before he quit, and then moved away, and then moved back after running against John Molinar and contemplating running against Tom Casperson in the first.
But he also has some roots in the district, though, doesn't he?
28 days of roots, yes. He bought a farm. He bought a farm just inside the district line. And again, so he's been there for 28, he was there 28 days before he filed. And I think that people meet him, they get to know him, and they still think, you know what? They've seen where he was in other places. I think, you know, one thing that you need to remember is a good portion of the media market for the Molinar seat covers that Thumb. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these folks saw the TV ads for him running in another seat not too long ago. And I think that, again, you know, the relationships run deep in Macomb County. That's why Jack Brandenburg's endorsement of Phil was so important. That's why Mike Green's endorsement of Phil was so important, because those relationships and those people that folks in that community know, their words are important.
All right, let's move on to the State House race, 2016. The Republicans have a good size advantage right now. If they would need to lose 9 seats in order to lose majority. But back in 2006, when you were the spokesperson for the House Republicans, it seemed like nobody was even thinking that the House Republicans would lose majority, and yet on the night of, it happened. And I still remember the next session day afterwards, the Democrats were wandering around and Jack was over there. It was like, what the heck happened? And they were just punch drunk because they didn't even see it coming themselves. So I bring that up to say, is it possible, do you see any correlations between the 2006 election and this one right now?
I think there's going to be a wave, I think, of negativity, I think, towards the Republican side. I think the one thing that the House Republican leadership has going in its favor this year that we did not in 2006 was that no one can say they didn't see this coming. If anyone has watched this primary season and what's going on with Donald Trump at this point, if you don't know that trouble is coming, you're not paying attention. And they have plenty of time to try to compensate, to campaign around that fact. The difference was, and you were right, at 1 o'clock in the morning, we didn't know we were going to lose majority. I mean, it was a complete surprise and a shock. And I think it was a complete underestimation on a lot of parts about how unpopular the war was and how unpopular President Bush was at the time. And I can remember the early parts of that campaign, our mail pieces had the president in them. I mean, we were talking about the president, and things switched quickly, pretty dramatically, as far as the popularity of that, and it was a national wave that the House Republicans got caught up in. And I think, again, that's going to be the difference. That, you know, this time, I think they should be sitting there, and they can see the wave on the horizon. So, now, they just need to get out of the way.
So you don't expect to see any House Republican literature with Trump on it?
I would be shocked. I wouldn't. I would never run for the House either. So.
Come November, what do you think putting all their chips behind a Trump candidacy would mean?
If a House candidate? To me, doing that takes your campaign completely off message, because all that does is now you have to talk about everything he's saying and defend everything he's doing, as opposed to talking about what you want to talk about. You can support him. You can say, I'm going to support the nominee. But as soon as you say, I'm with him, he's the best thing ever, then every day you're going to be dealing with press releases and stage press conferences from the House Dems saying, denounce this, denounce that, you know, and that's you talking about something that's not about your campaign. And it just isn't a smart way, I don't think, to run your race.
No matter how far a Republican candidate gets away from or distances themselves from Trump, do you think that he's an advantage for the Democratic candidate? I've been hearing that Trump is a good tool for them to fracture the Republican base. I mean, what do you think the effect is, regardless of how far the Republican candidate distances?
The best advantage it gives the Dems, I think, is just some disaffection, disinterest that a Republican voter who, you know, would likely go vote may decide not to go vote if they are if they're put off by Trump. You know, the one unknown factor, that one, we've seen it, and I mean, to his credit, there are clearly people who are voting for him that have not voted before. I mean, he has tapped into a group of people in large numbers who are active in this process, are very enthusiastic about this process. So that, you know, that is the one unknown, is how many of those people come to the polls and demonstrate themselves to be loyal Republicans or Republicans at all. Mm-hmm. And if that ends up, you know, balancing things out, so to speak.
All right, very good. Matt Resch from Resch Strategies. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, Matt Resch, for joining us here. And congratulations to MDOT and the contractors for opening up Martin Luther King between Ottawa and Saginaw. Hooray. It was only 3 weeks, guys. I mean, that was pretty impressive, wasn't it? We got a brand new road. I don't have to worry about a car alignment for my car now that the potholes have all been...
Except they missed Butler right over here.
Butler is in bad, bad shape.
Butler between, yeah.
Between Ottawa.
Ionia and Ottawa. It's terrible. You lose.
Yeah, the Butler pothole, which we've probably talked about before, either on the podcast or on the staff, is probably a city landmark at this point. So they're not going to be fixing it anytime soon. So it's part of our historical landscape here.
Or they could be doing pine next. You know, pine before you get to Ottawa, if you're going from Saginaw. That I think that's just one continuous patchwork of pothole covering.
That's an emergency status if they're for wood.
I mean, anybody who's driven on Michigan Avenue, I would love it if someone could explain to me what we're accomplishing on Michigan with 2/3 of the road closed and 4x4-foot patches of new asphalt. I haven't been able to wrap my head around that one.
I think we all know where we all drive then, right? Suggestions now that, thank you for Martin Luther King, we have some other things that we'd like to do. Maybe the whole road funding package that we got will help address some of these, right?
Starting 2017.
Woohoo!
Get that lockbox open.
Get the lockbox. Crack it open. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.